Well, good morning, everyone. I should have said it a little bit quieter in case some of you were partying as hard as I was last night. So that's normal for cons, though, right? You get here and it's just like, okay, everything's in excess, so I just have to drink the same way, going to excess that way. Start early, yeah. I'm going to wait at least another hour or two, so I won't be drinking until then. Till then, it's just a bit of caffeine. So, hi, everyone. I'm Randall Schwartz. I'm your tour guide for the next hour. You probably know me from one or two different things. I wrote a bunch of books about Pearl. Anybody have any of my books about Pearl?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. All right. Not all of them. I've got some of them still in the house. So, okay. You can't possibly have all of them. And the real reason I'm here today, at least this morning, is that I host a podcast called Floss Weekly. And how many of you are subscribers to Floss Weekly? Wow, cool. All right. All 22 of you are my entire audience is here. Great. That's cool. So, actually, it's a little bit better than that. We'll get to that when we get to the numbers here. So, what I want to talk about today, love that, yes. So, I want to talk about the podcast itself, probably not news to most of you since you listen to it. I also want to abstract it a bit. I want to look at the things that we've seen over and over again and having interviewed 180 different shows now. And I also want to give you kind of a peek behind the scenes. How do we produce the show? What's actually going on when I'm looking down on different corners of the screen? You probably see me like over here and over. I'll tell you what's actually on the screen. So, the podcast has been around since 2006, April of 2006, and as the name says, it's theoretically weekly. We do occasionally miss some. Not so much now. We're actually almost back on a normal, complete, accurate schedule all the time. It's an interview show, so we have a specific guest or sometimes two or three guests on one topic. 45-minute interview in the center. Then I also have some opening and closing stuff, the beginning and the end, kind of set the show up, and then also tell about what's coming up next. And that's where also me and the co-host plug where we're going to be next. Like I kept talking about Dragon Con last year, 4 weeks this year. We have both audio and video format, and that's actually new. The show started originally as just an audio show, but Leah Laporte and the Twit Network have been moving towards being a full-time video place as well. So we have a live video feed. We also... we'll take the video of the show and put that out in video format, both small and large format. So now I actually have to know that my face is going to be on screens for a while. It's like, hold it. When it was just, it was just audio, it was okay. I have a face made for radio, so I want to make sure that I don't have it set up that way, right? And one of the advantages in having this shot live is that we also have an IRC channel that we use behind the scenes. So while you're watching the show, we get questions from the audience, and the audience is as big as 4,000 or 5,000 people sometimes. And that's kind of freaky to think that here I am sitting here in my little webcam, and I'm going out to 5,000 people, and they're all sitting there in the chat room and chatting along or watching along and able to feed back to that. So it's kind of cool. And this is where it's really gotten interesting. The monthly downloads are somewhere in the six-figure region. I have somewhere between 30 and 60,000, depending on the show. So nobody's challenged me on this, but I believe it's the most downloaded open-source podcast out there. And part of that is due to the fact that it's on the Twit Network, and all these other great technology shows are on there, so I kind of get to ride along with that particular fame. The production cost is covered in two ways. First, when we don't have ads, which we've actually had some good ads recently, but when we don't have ads, Leo is paying for this out of his pocket because he still has to have the production person there and the editors who put the thing together and the bandwidth that fortunately is subsidized by the cash fly. But the actual production work, he's paying for this out of his pocket. And that got me worried for a while because when we couldn't find anybody to be a sponsor of the show, I said, well, does that mean I have to, am I counting the days till you stop? He goes, no, I really love this show. I am absolutely, you will always have this show on the Twit Network. It's not going to be a problem with paying for out of his pocket. So I really appreciate that. But when we do find a compatible ad, it's great because, I just drop it in my little ad mode. I go in for about 2 minutes reading the ad copy, mostly for Netflix. Leo also has really high integrity with the ads. He won't have hosts talk about things they don't believe in. So that was also part of the problem, is I had to figure out things that I was actually using that were sort of compatible with the audience too. And I tell you, I get complaints about Netflix, DRM, and I go, well, come on, guys, I got to pay for the show somehow, okay? And it is one product I actually use, so I want to, there's integrity there for me. So. How I got into the show actually was sort of interesting because Chris DiBona, some of you may know him from being around, he's works for Google. He used to do a lot of work with Slashdot and a bunch of other things, but he started the show. He actually approached Leo about doing an open source podcast, and that's how the show got about there. Now, in parallel with that, I met Leo on one of my cruises. You might have heard me talk about these Insight cruises, Geek cruises that I do. In fact, I'm on one next week from Vancouver to San Diego, and then I'm on one about a month from now from Rome to Athens. Such a tough life. I know. So I get no sympathy for my jobs. It's just horrible. That. Okay. So I met Leo on one of the cruises, and it was sort of fun because, you know, I admired him from afar, from, you know, tech TV and those kinds of things before that. And it was really interesting finally meeting him in person. And we go about 3 or 4 days into the cruise, and we had these things called ingenious bars. We didn't want to use the ingenious bars, so we had these places where the speakers would show up at a certain time at one of the bars on the ship. And so I sit there, and I'm answering questions, too, and he goes, how did you get into computers? You know, what do you – I go, I'm Randall Schwartz, the Pearl book guy. And he looks at me and he goes, oh, my God, I've got your book on my shelf. I was just reading it the other day. And I'm like, well, yeah. I said, I've been a big fan of yours for a long time. He goes, I've been a big fan of yours for a long time. So that was how we met. It was really cool. 4 days into the cruise, he just thought I was this guy hanging out with my buddy Neil who puts on the cruises. So it was pretty funny. All of a sudden, he puts it together. Oh, that, you're that guy. And that's how we started. So we had a great set of conversations after that. And actually, I asked him about how to do a podcast because I was curious about, you know, we have all these great speakers on the cruises, and I wanted to get some of that information out to the world. And so he told me about sort of what the mechanism's like and how to set up a podcast. Not really that tough, but the big problem is stamina. Okay, that's one thing nobody has enough of, and it's the one thing everybody forgets that they're going to need. So anyway, so in the part of these conversations, I had been listening to Floss Weekly, and I said, well, why haven't I been on Floss Weekly? And he goes, oh, dude, let's do that. So episode 9, there I was. So that was my introduction to the show, was actually being a guest on episode 9. And we didn't just talk about Pearl. We talked about the cruises. We talked about all sorts of great things. It was a really fun time for me to be interviewed on the show, and actually because Chris DeBona and I go back a ways as well. Now, so the show stopped after 17 episodes. This is what I said. It takes stamina. There's this, even this word for it. It's called pod fade. That's when the show gets away. It's not going to happen anymore. And really, to Chris's credit, Chris had a baby. Well, no, his wife had a baby, but he was involved somehow. All right. So so what happened is the show stopped. Nothing was happening for like 3 or 4 months. And Leo, in parallel, invited me to go be on his television show that he was taping up in Canada, Vancouver, BC, called The Lab with Leo. I don't know, how many of you have seen episodes of Lab with Leo? It's a fun little show. It was like it's a technology show, but more aimed at a lower level, like consumer level technology. But there were some geeky things occasionally. So Leo invited me to come on and present some things. I did some things on Wi-Fi security, as you all know from a couple years ago here. That's one of the things I pay attention to. And so I did stuff on Wi-Fi security. I even did one episode where I was using the tilt sensor in the MacBook Pro, and there was like a dozen different games and stuff that play with these. So I was like making lightsaber sounds with my laptop and stuff. Just real visual stuff, real fun stuff. Well, during one of the breaks while I was taping, I said, so what's going up with Floss? Is it going to come back ever? And he gave me this very straight answer. He said, you bring me some guests and you can co-host. That's how it works. I went, wow, that's all it takes? He goes, yeah. So it took me a few months to get my first show out, July 2007. And it took about a year to actually get it up to weekly because there's just a lot of work in asking people to come on the show and coordinating the time, stuff like that. And we had a really great opportunity one week to get John O'Bacon on the show. John O'Bacon was a really, really entertaining, interesting guy. And he's the Ubuntu community coordinator. So he does a lot of stuff with Ubuntu. He's got a wonderful British accent, so that's always handy, too, because you get somebody with the odd-sounding, odd to me anyway, sounding speech. I know some of you are going to argue, no, that doesn't sound odd. You sound odd. No. Okay. So he came along, but a great thing happened. Before he was even on the show, he called me up ahead of time, and he said, well, you know, if you ever need somebody to fill in for you, if you're going to be gone, I'd be happy to do that, too. And I went, huh, a co-host. That would be a co-host, actually. Could bring them both on. So it was great. So for about 6 months, Jono was actually on the show as a co-host whenever he could be there, and it gave a completely different perspective because my background isn't really in Linux. I'm an open source advocate, but I don't run Linux anywhere. We'll talk about that in a minute as well. But I don't run Linux anywhere, so I'm not used to this whole idea of Linux desktops and things like that, and Jono was perfect on that. So Leo was like the everyman, and Jono was like the Linux expert, and I was like the everything else expert. So it worked out really well in terms of dividing the questions up. Well, then we had some more shuffling around. The schedule at Leo's place changed all around, and the problem is that the show that we had been taping Wednesday afternoons with Leo on it got moved to Wednesday morning before Leo was even at the studio. So now it was a problem. It was a great opportunity because Leo says, go ahead and just host the show. Be the whole producer. Do everything. It's fine. You're obviously qualified. We've done a lot of shows together. You know how the thing works. Just take it over. And that was really nice. That was really nice to entrust me with this show that was already had established a really good following and stuff. I think at that point it had about 15 or 20,000 downloads. So Leo moved on to other projects. So I became the host as well as the producer. And that was a whole different game for me. I was already producing. I was already getting people lined up and setting up the studio and everything about how it all had to happen. But we got a downside, though, which is that Jono wasn't available in the morning. It turns out that if you're working for a company that's partly in the UK and partly in the US, the mornings are very precious. All your conference calls happen then because that's the only time that overlaps with what's happening around halfway around the world. So I had to ask myself what to do. And for those of you around listening to the show at this time, I had to fill Jono's shoes with five people. If that's how important he was to me, I had to get five other people to actually fill his slot. My co-hosts, and still current co-hosts, most of these guys are, Aaron Newcomb, who works for Oracle, was working for Sun at the time, or I like to call it Snorkel, because it's Sun, or Snorkel, right? So he's been on a lot of times. He also has his own podcast, so he's very good as a co-host and as a replacement host when I can't be there, because he already understands how the process works. I also had Aaron Siegel on a couple of times, or one time as a former guest. No, I had him on as a guest, and then he came back and co-hosted for a while. He's been really busy lately, so I haven't been able to bring him back as a co-host, but he was really great for that. And also FreeBSD girl. The caffeine's finally kicking in, I can already tell. All right, Randy Harper, she's been really great as well. She brings a different sort of element to the show, which is always handy. And my friend Simon Phipps, big open source advocate, worked at Sun, actually was sort of the open source coordinator for Sun until Oracle bought him and basically ruined everything, but that's another part of the story. All right. And another co-host, Dan Lynch, he's the host of Linux Outlaws. Some of you may also listen. How many people listen to Linux Outlaws? See, good overlap. I like that. Yeah. Dan's really great, too. And he also brings back that the UK voice. So now we can still have somebody that sounds like Jono did. So Linux Outlaws is a great show. I have argued all the time that I don't want Floss Weekly to turn into a news show, because it just takes way too much work to do news. And I'm glad that they do that. They just handle all the news every week. It's a really great thing. I've been a guest on their show a couple of times now. In fact, I was just on a few weeks ago, again, just prior to coming here to DragonCon, and we just chatted about all sorts of things. And they have a video now. I was their guinea pig, their first video interview. And I have an authentic cowboy hat from when I was, I owned a bar in Eastern Oregon for a while, and Eastern Oregon's all cowboys and stuff. So I actually got the entire outfit from head to foot, including a $150 hat, a real honest to goodness cowboy hat. So I wore that for the entire video. So I'm sitting here in a black shirt and my black hat and going, yay, so I'm a cowboy now. All right, so real Linux outlaw. These guys really helped me out, because what happens during the process of the taping is I'll go through four or five questions and then I'll kind of stall a little bit. I'll need to start thinking of the next question. And as you'll see in a moment, we actually have a way of taking care of that. So I'll wait for that until I get to that point there. So I've had a lot of really, really great people in 180 episodes on the show, but I wanted to sort of center on a few people that I thought were the most interesting. So I narrowed the list down to the 10 favorite people interviews that I did and the 10 favorite projects that I did. So here's the list that I came up with of all the shows that I were there. And this is the show number 22. Fernanda Wyden now works for Google. I met her because she's also one of the coordinators of FISLE, which is the big open source conference in Brazil that I go to every year. And she's a really amazing person. Just gets, you know, organizer, gets things going. And we talked a lot about, you know, her role with FISLE, but also just, you know, the controversy and the complexities of getting more women into open source technology, open source conferences and things like that. So that's a great show for just hearing sort of the overall stuff of that. Episode 29 was Dan Ingalls. Dan is one of the co-creators of the Smalltalk programming language. So he was at Xerox PARC back in 1974 to 1980 at least. It was fun listening to him talk about that, because some of the inside stuff about the way Smalltalk got created, and by the way, if you don't know the history, Smalltalk is what gave us Windows and mice. So the reason this laptop has a mouse and it has a overlapping display like that is because of Smalltalk. So Dan Ingalls talked about that process, also talked about how when Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak came over, kind of what they saw in the systems that they were being shown, and of course that created the whole Macintosh and everything else that we've got out of that. Great interview, really good. And the other thing I like, though, is that he left the computer industry for about 10 years and worked on something completely unrelated to computers, then came back. So it was a fun story to listen to about all that as well. Simon Phipps, who eventually became my co-host, but he has some deep insight about open source software and the functioning of open source software in business And it's always a pleasure talking to him because he's always got this sort of keen thoughts about how to make it all work. I really enjoyed the relationship I've had with Simon and being able to come on the show a lot. And, of course, John O'Bacon, great guy who's on, actually, I think he was on two or three times as a guest. He talked about the latest Ubuntu release one time, and the other time he talked about his community developing book that he had. And, of course, he co-host for a long time, too. Tim O'Reilly, another longtime friend of mine. Tim O'Reilly, of course, is the O'Reilly and O'Reilly and Associates, the people that produce the books that I write. So right about that time, the big issue, the big controversy was open data and being able to have access to your data, because we were talking about all these new social mediums coming in and how the data gets all locked up behind the scenes. And so great conversation about getting that on, and also talking about the origins of the O'Reilly, the origins of the OSCON and things like that. So really great show. David Hennemeyer Hansen, you might know him as DHH, is a creator of Ruby on Rails. This was also a really fascinating interview about how Rails started as just a project that was being used to build the was it 37 Signals? Yeah, 37 Signals websites, and yet they decided to factor it out and produce that, and now that's the thing we mostly know about the organization over there. This is also a controversial episode because DHH has colorful language. I think it's probably the easiest way to say that. And I was sort of worried that, you know, because these talks actually get used in schools sometimes. I've heard that from teachers who told me, yeah, I really like what you're doing here. We didn't put bleeps on. We left it as is. And I did get some flack for that. Like, there's sort of a... I should have thought about at least putting a disclaimer at the beginning, but it had already gone out to production, so I couldn't do that. So, anyway, there you go. Listen to that. If you want to hear some words that are worth bleeping, yes, right. Linus? Yeah, Linus Torvalds, of course, big, you know, Linux, that's where Linux comes from. He barely agreed to do a show. He hates, he said, is this that radio thing? It was pretty funny, yeah. I'm sure he gets so many requests for interviews, but this was at LinuxCon, which they deliberately held in Portland, Oregon, his home city, so that he would come. You know, this year it's in Vancouver, but last or 2 years ago it was at LinuxCon in Portland. And I remember we were going to go live with that show, but the hotel Wi-Fi was just ruined. It was just so slow, we couldn't do that. So I actually did the interview offline with me and Jono and Linus all sitting around a table, sort of looking like we're interviewing each other. We were just recording it so I could go in and send it to the feed later. So it's a good interview, though. Actually, I didn't actually ask very many questions about Linux. I wanted to hear about the rest of his life, and I'm sure he appreciated that as well. We did bring back Chris DiBona on the episode 100 as a celebration episode. So he talked about the latest things he's doing at Google, a lot more fun stuff there. And, of course, I brought in FreeBSD Girl as a guest. That's how we first met her. From that episode, besides finding out everything she's doing in terms of FreeBSD and the FreeBSD world, I found out about FreeBSD for the first time. So it was fun because I now run FreeBSD on all my servers. ZFS for booting, which is really nice. A big ports package and the PF firewall. It's kind of hard to beat that combination of things. So, and BSD rather than Linux, but okay, I'll shut up on that one. All right. But finally, the last one of the people episodes. Bob Jacobson, I was brought to his awareness, or he was brought to my awareness, because he was being sued for patent infringement on software he didn't write, but he was just simply the release manager for. And the patent was backdated because it had been attached to the shell of another patent that was still in the pending process. So even though the software was written long after the patent was first applied, the patent was amended to include the stuff the software had because they got it from him. They got the downloads. Amazingly twisted tale, and he's had something like $100,000 in legal fees come out of his pocket. And boy, if you've heard my stories here, you know I'm very sympathetic to that. That's just wrong. So again, it shows how screwed up software patents are. If you want to be a software patent advocate, please point them at this show, because there's a guy right in the jaws of this thing, and so it's really, really important show to listen to especially if you're against software patents. The project side is a little bit easier to pick on because most of our shows are actually project-related rather than people-based, although I like to mix it up a little bit, too. SQLite, well, that's actually a people show as well. Richard Hipp, an amazing guy. This guy writes this software to basically do SQL in a small setup, SQLite essentially where the name is, and he gives it away for free. In fact, it's actually released as public domain, as close as you can get to that. It doesn't even have a normal license because of that. But the most amazing thing is it's probably the most widely distributed database that you've never heard of. There's SQLite in here. If everyone here has a smartphone, there's SQLite in there. Everyone has a Chrome browser, SQLite in there. It's everywhere. So it's the most widely distributed database ever. And the guy did it and gave it away because that's what he wanted to do. I mean, it's just an amazing story. He's actually employed by the phone companies now. He gets money from them because they keep the thing working for him, or he keeps the thing working for him. So it's really cool, really great show. One of my first ones too, which actually turned out a lot better than I thought it was going to. MIFOs, that's microfinancing. The giant setup. These guys work out software so that you could give a $5 loan or a $10 loan to get somebody buy material in a developing country to make shirts and then return the loan back to that. Before, it had all been done using Excel spreadsheets and stuff, but these guys came along and figured out how to get some really nice professional-looking banking software so they could run these micro banks in all these developing places run them on laptops, so it couldn't be too powerful or hard to run. So I was really moved by that project to make that happen. jQuery. How many people here know what jQuery is? See, it's everybody here. Rezig was an amazing guy to talk to. John Rezig, the creator of jQuery. The best part about this interview is about halfway through, he says, "Well, Randall, the reason you'll probably like jQuery is because I like Perl. I've done everything I did in Perl before I got to jQuery." He went, "Yay!" So that was a lot of fun. So that's why I feel particularly satisfied by using jQuery, because it seems to work a lot like my brain thinks, because, again, done by a Perl guy, so therefore it's going to be weird like Perl. Right. Ole Nepal, we talked to the guy. Oh, God, I forgot his name. Sorry. We talked to the guy who was in charge of deploying the one laptop per child LPCs, the LXOs, in Nepal. And really, really moving story. They have essentially a 56K line coming into the school. I mean, it's nothing. It's a dial-up modem, right? That's, they have a 56K line, and these laptops all mesh together, so they can all exchange data back and forth without having to have central facilities for that. So they just have the one Wi-Fi hotspot, and then they all talk to each other, and it spreads it throughout the school. If the kids take the units home and they live close enough together, they can actually hop from one machine to the next to actually have access to the internet while they're at home. It's really, really amazing. And this guy was just, put this thing together and works with the schools and puts these pilot programs in place, and lots of politics involved with that, of course, but that's the way it is. Anyway, great story. He was also interesting because he was in Nepal at the time. I actually Skyped him from there, and I had to figure out some time to wake up that 13 and a half hour time zone differences weren't going to mess up. So it was, and a half. It's weird, a half time zone, just one of those strange ones. Okay, lots of fun there. OpenStreetMaps, again, another very important project. If you don't know about OpenStreetMaps, find out about it. Basically, the current mapping data that you might find like on an Android or a Google phone or iPhone, that all belongs to a couple of major companies that are basically charging Google to use these data, this map data. So what OpenStreetMaps is doing is they're going out and mapping it individually. They're just having people take their smartphones out and walk around and upload it, the data and stuff. So we had the guys on from there talking about the project and how it's actually helping. It's also very important in areas that don't have official map data available. Like there's some places in developing countries where there just aren't any maps made up. The government doesn't have them. Nobody has them. So these guys are running around filling out the mapping data for that. Really smart. Really cool. MakerBot. That was Bree Pettis? Bree something. Okay, Bree. One of those. Bree was really fun to chat with. MakerBot is a device that you feed three-dimensional designs into, and it uses this hot plastic, same stuff that Lego is made out of, and builds whatever you want to build, almost whatever you want to build, because it has to sit on itself, has to keep growing up like this. And midway through, I asked him, well, can you print like a plastic, like a sharp knife, and Leo goes, don't ask him questions like that. And he goes, well, yeah, we can actually do that. It's just, you could have like a knife that you would not be able to detect in a metal detector. I went, oh yeah, that's kind of where I was going with that. So, but the best part was that he also said that he had a different machine that was essentially a frosting pourer, so you can squish out squishy things, right? And I said, so you could, so like foods too? Could you do like chocolate pudding or something, or make stuff? He goes, well, it kind of has to sit. And I go, oh, so you could feed in the design for your own head into this, and you could have a brie made out of brie. And bad puns. Every show I get like one bad pun, and it's my craziness there. The Mars rover drivers. This was a really special episode for me. Not a lot of open source is used there, but darn it, I had the connection. So I said, I want to go interview these guys because they have the coolest job out of this world, not just in this world. It was really cool, though, because as we're talking to Scott and the other guy's name, bad with names, as we were talking to these guys, it was very clear to me that they really enjoyed their job. They went to work every day. We're just having a great time doing it. But then, as we got closer to the end of the interview, I said, so how is open source actually being used around there? You know, well, I actually tie the show in finally. And he says, well, you won't believe this, but he says, when we try a maneuver and discover that the maneuver is, you know, a little wonky and we probably shouldn't do it that way again, we take the rules for what that was and we put it into this giant Perl script. And every day's run after that goes through this giant Perl script to invalidate anything that would be a wonky move. And so, yes, in fact, Perl on that mission is mission critical, literally. I thought that was just amazing. You can hear me in the show. At that point, I just stopped. I don't know what to say next. And knowing that Perl's mission critical on this out-of-the-world project, that was a lot of fun. Speaking of Perl, we had Patrick Michaud on show number 140, Rokudo Perl 6. That was a surprising show for me because I actually found out that Perl 6 was farther along than I thought it was. There's actually, you know, Rokudo at this point, you can download it, you can play with it. There's not the equivalent of the CPAN being huge, but you can actually start getting a feel for how Perl 6 is going to eventually work. Probably another year before we get close to production, but even that, it's like early alpha adopters. So, but it's out there. It's actually usable at this point. People are writing web servers in Perl 6. It's pretty cool stuff. OpenPilot. Oh, this is... they haven't sent me those things yet, by the way. So OpenPilot is UAV controlling software. So they have these quadcopters and these planes. And the hard part about controlling a quadcopter is there's like a lot of things that all have to be correlated in terms of lifting and sitting and stuff. So these guys are creating open source software that sits actually on the quadcopter. And you tell it commands like, go up 5 feet. And then it just goes up 5 feet and holds there. So you're not actually flying it like having to move the joysticks around. You're actually just giving it commands. These big quadcopters can hold 3 pounds. So they've been flying cameras around, doing surveillance with these things. Sounds dangerous, doesn't it? Yeah. But that was a lot of fun talking to these guys. And they had good videos. So that's the one episode, if you're going to see it only on video, yeah, definitely that's the right way to go for that. And just recently we had Sunlight Labs on. Sunlight Labs is a group of people in Washington, D.C. that are trying to get all that open data that should be there that Obama promised out to the world by providing web apps, by providing iPhone apps. Basically, you now can go in and find out exactly who's voting on what and what they're saying and stuff, all mostly because of the work of these guys. And there it was interesting because it was obvious to me that the... well, because these guys told me that the government wants to open this data up, or at least the current government does. Who knows what's going to happen next, right? The current government wants to open this data up, but some of this stuff was written by government contracts from long ago and in really stupid languages and stuff, and nobody's around to actually manage this stuff. So they've got the data in the machines. They want to get it out, but they can't figure out, you know, they don't have the resources and time, energy, all that sort of stuff. So, but it's great that there's a project there trying to push this along. It's really, really, really good for that. So, again, lots of great episodes. Those are my 20 favorite ones, though. So if you want to just start and get a sense of what Floss Weekly is about, I would say go listen to those and for the reasons I just gave you. So I've noticed, though, in doing this show over and over and over again, that there are some recurring themes that seem to come up in every show in terms of why open source, how it happens, how the community happens, and so on. So here's the headlines. We'll go through and look at each one of these. In a sense, scratching your own itch, sharing for feedback, sharing for the community. You don't have to be a starving artist with open source. There's no need to be geographically near. There's really no age limit, no application limit. Well, let's just go ahead and get the headlines here. Why stare on that page for a bit? So scratching your own itch. And by that, I mean that this is how a lot of these projects start. Somebody has their own problem, their own thing, and they start writing software to solve that. Thank God for programmers like us, right? Okay. And so someone solves a problem for themselves, right? But then... having the idea that maybe there are other people out there that have similar problems, they go, well, hey, I've got this software that fixes this now. Or maybe somebody else asks them, do you have anything that does this? And they say, yeah, we do. That's how Perl started, for example. Larry Wall had had a need to have something smarter than awk, and he said, well, other people may want this, and that's how I found out about Perl. And the other thing, too, that's handy about this, and this, we saw this over and over again, is that being your own first customer also brings focus to the product, because it's hard to design code in a vacuum. You really need somebody drawing you along. You need to say, here's the goal, here's what I'm trying to solve. And if you're your own first customer, you can definitely do that easily, because you go, what do I need it to do? And so also, because we're working with a lot of the same problems over and over again, it's likely that you have the problem, other people do, too. So by sharing it, you can end up having more people have their problem solved instead of just you. Now, where open source comes in, and we saw this over and over again, is that it means that other people can also help make the code better. So once I've shared the code, because it's open source, they can figure out things to make it do that I couldn't make it do and contribute the code backwards to us. And they can also customize a solution. So, not, you know, my problems aren't exactly your problems, at least I hope not. So, you know, when I hand my software over to you, the fact that it's open source means that you can modify it and fix your particular things as well, and hopefully bring it back when you can. Also, by sharing code, by opening it up, you're being in public and you get feedback. Maybe there's something in the design that could have been done differently. You know, by having open source, people can say, oh, you should just use this library. It would have made it a lot easier. Even feedback on the coding style. You're using a way that's really dangerous with pointers. Don't do that, that sort of thing. Feedback on security, very important. By having, you know, not all of us are security experts, so it's important to have somebody else's set of eyes looking at the code. Feedback on compatibility. You know, I really like this piece of software, but it won't play with my particular XML files that I'm using or whatever. So getting feedback like that lets your product get better as well. Feedback on the documentation. Usually the question is, what documentation? So, but to get that kind of feedback, help people recognize what's going on. And also feedback in the sense of somebody saying, you know, if you just had this feature, it would be better for me. Here, let me add that for you. You know, so get resources by getting this kind of open source and feedback. And that sort of leads me to the next point, too, which is that once you're in public, you're also building community, because you're ending up finding people and groups with similar problems. So now we're starting to share and converse about this particular thing. So one of the things we've also seen is that the successful communities have easy-to-use communication channels. And this includes things like having their code in a public code repo. That's really, really important to have the growth of your project. If you only have an email address to send patches to and you release a tarball every 3 months, you are not going to build as a community. It just doesn't work that way. So, you know, we've got all these great tools now. We've got, you know, GitHub and now Google Code now has Git, which is nice. Google Code's been a great place to host stuff. SourceForge, I remember, haven't used that in a while, so I'm trying to remember what that was, right. Anybody else still use SourceForge? Anyway, okay, a few, all right. So be sure you have a public code repo, and also, again, the successful projects that we talk to have open bug trackers as well, so people can see what other people are looking at in terms of what's broken. That's very, very helpful. Also, of course, the traditional things like mailing lists, forums, IRC, almost every project we talk to has an IRC channel on Freenode. So apparently that's really gotten to be pretty cool. I had Freenode as a guest, by the way, as well. So we cover all the bases that way. And also, it's important to stay in touch. So having things like a blog for different news items that come along. Almost every project we talk to now has some sort of blog where the developers can post that we're working on this or we're going to have a new release on that and so on. And a few of them even have their own podcasts. And again, I'm going to talk a little bit about the production in a few minutes, but it's not that hard. But it's also something that you need to be committed to. If you're going to start a podcast, please know that it's a little harder than you think, but not too bad. I'm being wonderfully ambiguous about that, but yeah, it's somewhere above medium hard. How's that? We'll just make up the terms as we go along. Okay. Now, again, all these projects out there, you know, the one thing I hear from people who aren't aware of open source software yet is like, well, how would you make any money if you're giving away the software for free? I hear this over and over again. So if you'll notice in a lot of these podcasts now that I've done, a lot of the interviews, I've said, well, now, is this a labor of love or are you actually making money? And they tell us how they make money. So the software is no cost, but that doesn't mean your time has to be. You know, so you can get paid to add features. I've gotten paid to write a bunch of CPAN modules by my clients, so it all works out nicely that way. You can get paid to fix bugs, because if it's important enough to get rid of the bug for a client to be able to get that to work, then you can get paid to do that. One of my favorites is teach. I've done a lot of training in my life now, and it's one great way to make money on open source software. Write documentation, that sounds familiar as well. I've written a lot of documentation as well. And Simon Phipps hates me when I talk about this stuff, but yes, you can also have premium versions. So we have like the open core model that you get as a community edition or an open source edition, and then the company has a different version that's bigger and better, it has more features, and they stay locked up as proprietary software. I know it's pure open source advocates get freaked out about that stuff, but if that's one way that you can have a nice open core that people can use, you know, so be it. Make some money doing that. Another thing that we saw was that a lot of these projects are geographically diverse. The people are all over the place. And, of course, with modern technology, that's really not a big deal. We go on a Skype, we go on a Google Chat, whatever we have to do, there's always ways to be around. Email is good for non-real-time conversations. IRC is good for real-time conversations. And as the projects get bigger, we also saw that a lot of them started adding global or regional meetups, which is really handy to be able to sort of get face to face with people. I mean, I remember when Pearl was the big dog in the web from 94 to 2000, and there was something like 300 Pearl Monger groups all around the world. It's down to like about 50 now, but there was 300 of these groups, and every city I would go into, I'd be able to go hang out at a Pearl Mongers meeting. So it's just, it was really fun for that. And so many projects, again, also have local users group as well. So those kind of meetups are very important as the project gets bigger, because you really need to know there's people behind the project, and there's always a lot of good camaraderie that happens with things like this. I don't need to explain this being at a con, but yeah, it's a really great place to meet like-minded people. On the internet, no one knows you're 15. You know, well, they might if you had to sign something. But what's interesting is, and I was really surprised by this, Compiz, which is the graphics, the windowing management system for the latest releases of Ubuntu, I think it is. I forget the, I listened to the episode recently. He started when he was 13. He became a key committer by the time he was 13. Now he's running the project. He's like 19 now. But you know, this is the kind of thing. There is no age limit to this. And I say as an old graybeard, this really inspires me. It's really nice to see the youth coming in and really contributing and delivering and making things happen. So I'm really happy about that. Also, there doesn't seem to be any kind of application limit. Every kind of software has some open source version, and like the Mars Rover project, right? But we have desktop apps, lots and lots of stuff. Linux on the desktop, FreeBSD on the desktop. Operating systems, entire operating systems written as open source. Embedded software, I mean, it'd be hard to imagine, you know, there not being open source software, even like in thermostats and everything. All these places have at least stuff like that. Programming languages, pretty much every programming language now is implemented as open source to start with. And what I like to call is enterprise-y stuff. People with a lot of acronyms and stuff and like that. I don't understand all that enterprise stuff, but we have an episode like that about every 2 months, and I just cut my eyes glaze over. So apparently it's important to somebody. Okay. Other thing we learned by talking to people is that open source means you can fork. That means make a separate copy of the project and take it in its own direction. But you shouldn't fork too lightly, because one of the problems is that if you're forking because somebody just said, well, they wouldn't let me do this, I'm going to take my toys and go home, the problem with that is that it's often a bad thing, because you start breaking the community apart and it starts being an issue. But it could turn into a good thing. I mean, the reason we have OpenBSD, which is probably the most secure BSD out there, is because Theo didn't get along with some of the people on the, was it NetBSD? Or NetBSD project, right. So that's how it happens, you know. And Dragonfly BSD is because the guy wouldn't get commit rights. So we have this sort of thing, but it occasionally lets us get in there. But again, the reason to worry about this is that it dilutes the project size. And also, even though you know you may be at the top fighting your little ego war with whoever's out there, the users probably don't care. So now it's going to seem like, well, why is there two projects now? What's the deal here? I mean, a lot of people are really confused about the Hudson Jenkins fork, because they're going, what's really going on there, until they really find out that everybody's left Hudson. There's like nobody working on it now. They're all working on Jenkins. It's just completely slid over too. And in fact, that's my next point, is that forking might also protect against takeovers. Many recent projects have had to fork to continue. Like we had MySQL, which became MariaDB and Drizzle, and all the people that used to be working on MySQL are now working on the other projects instead. We had Open Solaris is now Illumos. Well, yeah. And so that's had to fork. You're going to notice a theme in all the ones I'm pointing out. Hudson becoming Jenkins. And let's see. I can't believe they haven't figured out how to destroy VirtualBox yet, though. I don't know how VirtualBox has come under the radar, just not had a problem yet. I don't think they know they have it. That's got to be the only way that Oracle has not messed that one up yet. By having this sort of ability to fork, we can keep carrying the project forward. And that also means you better get the license correct. Because one of the problems that Monty has, Monty with MySQL, is that the license is kind of wonky to start with. So Maria can't be exactly everything MySQL is, because some of the stuff is still tied up. So kind of annoying that way. So just a quick issue on licenses here. There's really a couple of major categories of licenses. The GPL restrictive license, and it really has a two-tier approach. Everybody talks about it being like everyone has everything equally, but really, think about it. The original copyright holder has far more freedom than everybody after him, because the original copyright holder can do what he wants with the code, and everybody else gets to only that little restrictions that the original holder had. So the licensees all have equal but far less freedom. So there are some situations where that's absolutely appropriate. I know sometimes people say I hate the GPL. I don't hate the GPL. I just think people choose it too often. Because I'm more like the BSD-style license, which is that all the licensees have all the freedom of the author, including the freedom to not pass that along. So it's more equal until it gets further down the line. So the GPO mostly guarantees the patches flow back. There have been examples where that hasn't been true, but mostly that. But I'll tell you, if you want your code to be used in more places, the BSD style licenses will allow it to be used in a lot more places. And I say this because I've been in a lot of companies where they say, we can't touch the GPL on anything in here because we're worried that if we redistribute something, the GPL is going to taint it. We can't have that happen. Right or wrong, you know, that's not up for me to decide, but that's how they stand. Now, if that's happening all the places that I've been, it's also happening a lot of other places as well. So if you want to make sure that you get your code used in the most number of places, a BSD-style license is almost essential, so keep that in mind. But I will say that both models have been very successful. So many projects we've heard of, I mean, Linux is obviously GPL, and FreeBSDs and the other BSDs are BSD-style license. Apache is basically a BSD-style license, and it's the number one web server out there. So it's you kind of just have to pick the right thing. It's up to what you want to accomplish with the project. How do we produce the show? How do we involve the audience, and why am I using a Mac laptop? Okay, so let's get to that. So the way I started getting the guests is I invited all the people I knew. Now, I've been around the industry for a long time, so I know a lot of really interesting people from all the conferences I went to and stuff. But I ran out of people I knew. And actually, that was Chris's problem, too. Leo told me that at one point, Chris had gone through all of his friends, and then there wasn't really much anybody else to invite. Not all of his friends, but you know what I mean, all the people that would be interesting for the show. So after I did about, I don't know, a dozen shows or so, and I'd already gone through my list of people, I asked the audience, do you have a suggestion? Oh, bad idea. Because I got flooded with duplicate requests. People say, oh, I want this. And I would get like 17 pieces of email that all had the same thing. So I had to get smarter about that. I said, how can I do this so that I'm still getting the requests in? Well, I figured out, just set up a Google Doc. So now I have this giant spreadsheet, you hear me refer to it in every show, that basically has a list of all the people that are on the potential guest list coming up front. The nice thing about that Google Doc, and the reason I could move to the Google Doc, is I figured out that I could actually have it be a view on a much larger Google Doc, which is where we actually have our show notes, our control information that the hosts share. So in other words, you're seeing the first two columns, the person and their schedule, and we also have to the right of that, in the private part, who's going to be a co-host for that show, what the email contacts are, how often we've tried to contact them and stuff. So I have it all. It's just one giant Google Doc for me. Really nice that they have this view capability so I can just show you the first two columns and I don't have to maintain that as a separate document. Very smart of them to do that. So now, you know, so for a while there, I was accepting, anybody could just make a suggestion about who to go see, right? And then I'd have to come around eventually and go, okay, here's the project name, let me Google for it. Here's the contact people. Where's the contact people? Where's the contact us link? It's amazing how many big open source projects don't have a way of getting a hold of the important people of them. Again, just a mistake on their part. So I got smart about this, though, because I was tired of getting all these requests in, right? So I said, okay, let's do it this way instead. You go do all that legwork for me, because you're probably already involved in the project, which is why you're suggesting it to me. You go do that legwork, figure out who should be on the show, and get them to email me. And that has been working a lot better. I get probably one request a week, and it's from some project leader who says, I've just now heard about your show. Apparently one of your fans wants me to be on your show. And it's really great mail because it comes in. And I don't have to, like, sell them on the show or anything. I just say, well, when do you want to go? You know, so much easier for my scheduling. And it went very, very nice for doing that. Again, using the power of the crowd, I'm able to diversify all this stuff because I'm not getting paid a lot of money. I make a little teeny bit of money from the sponsorship, but I'm not getting paid a lot of money for this. So for me to do 4 hours a week for essentially volunteer time, it's I don't want to take any more than that. So also, we've involved the audience in a different way. I've been created a Twitter handle and an Identica handle a few weeks back, and they're actually fed from a blog that I've set up on Posterous. So what's nice about that is that when I'm not there some week, because I'm not on every episode anymore, the other hosts don't have to have the passwords. They just simply log on to the blog, and the blog auto-posts when it works, auto-posts back to the Twitter and the Identica handle. The Identica people keep blocking the address that Posterous uses, some sort of rate-limiting thing. So it only works some of the time. Now, I had been doing this a lot on my own Twitter handle, Merlin, but apparently nobody wants to read my check-ins wherever I'm checking in. So they wanted to kind of separate that out, and apparently that's true because I lost about 100 people in the first week. So apparently, no, they really are just for Floss Weekly, but they didn't want to know what I had for lunch for some reason. So anyway, with that communication system, we announced the guests as they're booked. I also announced the confirmed guests for the upcoming week. So usually on the Sunday before the Wednesday that we tape, I'm usually doing the final paperwork. I'm making sure the guest is still knows that they're on the show. We had one guy forget one, so I mean, I do this email on Sunday every time. And about that time, I also post to the Posturist blog, which then auto-posts back to the Twitter stuff. And I also try to announce a live broadcast so people know that you can come on to live.twit.tv and see the show that's being taped and also give us feedback in the IRC channel. So I'm not going to talk a lot about the mechanics of the podcasting, but I will tell you, Linux Outlaws show number 200 did a really, really good job of describing what it's like behind the scenes to produce a podcast. So rather than me taking up any time here, just listen to that one. It's a great show. But the way we actually do it, though, is that we have Skype. We're using Skype between, it's no longer the cottage, it's the brick house. Sorry, this is an old slide. There's in Petaluma, California, they have a full production studio. And they set up a separate Skype call with each of us, so that me, my co-host, and the one or more guests that are going to be on the show. And they have this TriCaster, which is a video mixing system, and they mix that at the brick house. Every place you see cottage, put brick house in there, because it's now the new location. The other thing, too, is that the Skype feed that I'm looking at is also fed to live.twit.tv, so people at home are watching exactly what I'm seeing, although I get it about 7 seconds earlier, because Skype has to send delay before it goes out to the broadcasting systems. So the real trick that I figured out after a while was that the hosts, me and whoever my co-host is, actually have a Skype chat channel open the entire show as well. And what we're doing with that is that we're saying, okay, I'm running out of questions, your turn to take it. And that's really important. You wouldn't think it'd be very important, but when we didn't have that, two hosts would both ask questions at the same time, which becomes very awkward and embarrassing and hard for the guest to even sort out. So we actually coordinate who's talking when back and forth. You can do it when you're in the same studio. You can kind of have eye glances at each other to kind of know when we're going next. But over Skype, you know, I don't see my co-hosts most of the time because I'm in one room and they're in the other room, right? The other thing that's handy is that the brick house also monitors this. And so the guy switching the video back and forth knows which camera to take next because he's seen me say, okay, Dan, it's your turn. And Dan says, got it. And the next picture that comes up is Dan. Like it's all practiced, right? But that's how that actually all works. A little bit of mystery magic there. But it works. Works really well. And it comes across like a really produced show at this point, which is great. I also have a window up that monitors the public IRC channel. And the guests can watch this, but we advise the guests don't watch that channel. First off, we're not going to ask every question that comes up there. We're sort of moderating ourselves as well. Second, that channel goes off topic so often. And so it's just a stream of all sorts of other things. And I'm going, guys, do you have any questions for the guests? That's really what I'm here for right now. So it's a little bit tough that way. We had somebody on recently who was in the chat channel, and I didn't realize it till midway through the show, and he would just stop midway through his answer because something was coming up in the chat room, and I went, okay, this is not going to work very well. Also, those of you that watch the live show, know that we tape this out of order. We actually do the middle interview first. And the reason for that is I tell the guest, you're going to be on at 9:30 in the morning. I don't want to have him sitting through like 10 minutes of us doing our opening, especially if there's a technical problem or whatever. I don't want him to wait. So I say, you know, we'll start talking to you at 9:30, and then we go through and we do the interview, try to time that to be about 40 to 45 minutes, because I like this show to be exactly an hour long, and then we get rid of the guest, and we talk about them behind their back. So we recap the show, and then we talk about all of our stuff that we're going to be up on doing later and stuff. And so this out-of-order taping, then we go back to the opening. And for the opening, of course, we've already interviewed the guy. So when we talk about, well, we're going to have this guy on today, you know, we sound brilliant. We sound like we've done our research, but it's only because we've already talked to the guy. You know, so it works. It just works. So I didn't come up with this, by the way. This is the way Leo's been doing almost all of his shows that are interview shows. So it's just a little trick, and it seems to work pretty well. I do know this, though, from having done it with books. I always write my chapter one last because I don't know what I'm going to talk about until I've already written the whole thing, and now I can go back and do chapter one. Okay, the show is mostly live to tape, and what we mean by that is very little editing, except for major problems. And I tell the guests that, too. I actually have a huge paragraph or two of information about the production, and so in there I say, you know, if there's something that something you really blew and you really think we shouldn't put it in the show, we can go back and fix that, because we are taping this and editing it later. But the problem with that is it's already gone out live, you know, so it's kind of hard to control that, right? It's already gone out live. So the cottage rearranges the pieces, adds the fixed content, the opening, the header, and so on. And the audio typically goes out the same day. I've been actually pretty surprised at this. When we first started doing the show, the audio was like 2 or 3 days later. And now it's like, you know, I'm barely like, you know, going back to my day job, and all of a sudden I see the little announcement, hey, the show's ready. And I go, yay. The video is typically a day later, and mostly that's because of the CDN. They have to actually upload these videos to the CacheFly, and it takes a while for the CDN to say, okay, yes, it's everywhere now. The audio is short, so it happens right away. The cottage announces, the brick house announces that. I retweet that. I ask my guests to do the same. This is another part of this, the thing that I sort of learned over the years, is the more I get the guests to be involved with their own announcements, the more people find out about the show. Because we see people come in because they, you know, their particular arena, the guy, like say John Rezik for jQuery. So when John announces it to his audience, his followers, all of a sudden everybody who came to listen to it for jQuery is now going to stick around and go the following week with the next thing. I have people who say, I listen to every show. It's a lot of stuff I'd never use, but you know, what you're talking about in terms of open source and stuff, it's really important to us. So it's really handy that that show is there. So my audience keeps growing because I keep getting each new people's audience brought in. All works out nicely that way. Why Skype? Well, I'd love to use an open source solution. I really would. We've thought about it. We've worked on it. But Skype is easy to install for most people. And in fact, most people we talk to already have it. So they're already using it one way or another. Skype has this proprietary codec. That's the thing that turns the sound into numbers, and numbers back to sound and pictures as well. A very high performance. It has great audio and video and falls back nicely. When you start getting skipped packets in the Skype codec, somehow it just really deals with it well. There's no open source equivalent yet. A lot of people say there are, but no, nothing that's available readily everywhere else. We are currently exploring some alternatives, especially now that Microsoft, are they still on deck for buying Skype? I can't remember. I wrote this. Okay, yeah, which will suck. And the 5.0 interface also sucks. Except they just fixed this. This is great. So now you can actually, see, I have to have this chat window up, right? But I also want the video up of me, what I'm seeing at the cottage, or the brick house. So I'm not going to get over saying that for a long time. Okay, so up until the release that came out 2 or 3 weeks ago, I could choose either the video or the chat room. And I had to keep watching to see when I was on the video. I have to look for the little bouncing ball or whatever to see, oh, now it's time to switch to the other one. So they fixed this. So finally, okay. So Skype 5.3, the interface sucks slightly less. I think is about the only way to say that. But it's still horrible interface, horrible stuff. So we're kind of committed to using Skype. In fact, Leo just recently looked at using a whole different vendor solution and had it all deployed, told all his hosts about it, and had it all set up. And then the first week he used it, it was just horrible. So didn't go back. So now it's back to Skype again. We're all using Skype for everything again. Another question I get asked a lot, as an open source advocate, why am I using MP3s and MP4s? Why am I doing that? Well, again, except for the Netflix money or whoever the current sponsor happens to be, Leo's paying for this out of his pocket. There are limited resources at the brick house. There are also limited resources for bandwidth, because even though CacheFly essentially gives us the bandwidth for free, it's still bandwidth. I mean, they don't want to waste it on having multiple versions of that. There's also surprisingly limited demand. By this I mean that maybe about once every 3 weeks somebody says, why don't you have an ARG format? But that's one guy every 3 weeks. When we actually had a stream set up for a while, we had a total of like 80 subscribers. And that's a lot of work for 80 subscribers. Sorry to hear that. So we really can only afford at this point one audio, two video streams, and therefore, of course, we're going to use the formats that are most widely available to people, MP3 and MP4. As I said, we've had some experimental feeds, and that's the other thing, too. For some reason, they all break after like 2 months. Every time we've tried to do something like this, it just breaks. We've even had people that are third party say, we'll do it, and it breaks after 2 months. Makes computers angry or something. I don't know what the deal, but somehow it just keeps breaking. So that's why I'd love for there to be for the day that my iPhone would speak OGG so that I could use it there. But, you know, that's not the audience that we have. And, yes, I know it's kind of odd that Floss Weekly, a show about open source software, isn't in open formats, but there's the story. And also, why do I use a Mac? Now, I've made my living from open source for 20 years, so I'm a big open source advocate, but at the end of the day, I don't have any time to tinker, okay? I just want to get things done. My laptop, it boots up and it works. Stuff just has to work for me. You know, I have client stuff, of course, that I'm willing to build and get paid for, but when it's business overhead, I can't afford that. So, and also, I need smartphone integration. This has to be able to talk to that, you know? And I'm sorry, guys, Linux just isn't quite there yet. The coordination between the Android phones and the Linux systems isn't quite where I want it to be. It's not the same way as what I can get with this stuff. And so it's not perfect, but it's workable. However, you know, like I said, I use FreeBSD on my servers. I really like that, really stand for that. And I have also used OpenBSD, OpenSolaris, and originally I ran Linux on my servers, but not anymore. And I do use Mac ports on my Mac, so I've got all the lots and lots of tools there. I'm also one of the smoke testers for GNU Emacs, so every day I update my GNU Emacs and build the entire thing. So, you know, it's not like I don't use open source software. It's just like the framework just has to kind of work for me. I have over 300 ports actually installed of Mac ports on my laptop there. So that is just about the end, but I will tell you how to get a hold of me if you want. The podcast homepage is twit.tv/floss. Oh, that's already out of date as well. Look at that. For some reason, they went through and redesigned the entire website and gave long names to everything. But that breaks all the existing links. So I said, well, can you at least make it link back? And he said, okay, we'll make the twit.tv/floss actually redirect to the long name. And I went, why not just use the short names then? It's silly. It's, you know. Also, what they broke was twit.tv/floss123 pointing at show 123. And I'd been using those links forever to tell people about shows. So they did, in fact, after I complained, about a day later, they fixed everything. But it still redirects. It doesn't stay the short name now. It redirects to the long name. So that's really annoying. You can follow me at Merlin and see where my Foursquare check-ins come in and when I become mayor of places. That's a lot of fun. And also figure out where I'm at here, like for example. Floss Weekly, though, if you just want the Floss Weekly information, I have a personal blog, merlin.posterous.com. The Floss Weekly podcast, or Posterous, is completely about Floss Weekly, though. And everywhere else that I'm at, you know, I'm either Merlin, and if I couldn't get Merlin, I'm Real Merlin, because damn it, I'm the Real Merlin, or Randall Schwartz. I'm starting to use that a little bit more often as well. I'm also on Google Plus and a few other places. If anybody needs a Google Plus invite, by the way, I seem to have an infinite number of them. So it still says 150 after giving away about 100 of them. So I don't know. Maybe I'm special. I don't know. Anyway, that's the end of my talk. Got a few minutes for questions. Anybody have questions about Floss Weekly or about that? Yeah.
What text editor? Do you use on your Mac? Oh, what text editor do you use on your Emacs?
Okay, yeah. Cool. There's a little bit of me inside Emacs. I wrote the pretty printer that turns Emacs Lisp and indents it properly. I cheated with it, though. I needed a pretty printer. I knew I could see it from other places. So I said, well, Emacs Lisp needs one as well. And so I cheat. I do the whole string normally, and I just figure out where to put new lines and let it all sit on the left column, and then I call the indent region.
Yeah.
And just puts it out the right side.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I posted this pretty printer to the Emacs list, and Richard Solomon called it brilliant. So that's how it got adopted. So it was pretty cool. So a little bit of me in every one of the copies of Emacs now. So that's why I'm one of the advocates there. Any more questions? Over here.
So you were on Paul.com a couple weeks ago.
What.com?
Paul.com.com security.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and you said. That you wouldn't go into all the things that you disagreed with Steve Gibson about? Could you...
And there's a recording here, so no, I'm not going to go into here either. Well, let's just say it this way. I can no longer listen to that show. I just get too frustrated. Yeah, but I just noticed he just did something. I haven't listened to this yet, so don't spoil it for me. But he's doing something on like ICMP and TCP or something.
Yeah.
What do you think he got most of it right? Okay.
I'm not saying anything.
I'm going to listen. Oh, he does sound good. That's the thing. But
I respect you, Steve.
Yeah.
I respect you, Steve. You do a good job.
Yeah. Love the video on this one. Okay. Yeah, no. And it's funny because when I first met him, I had sent in so many comments on the first 50 shows or so. I was thinking he was just going to hate me the first time he meets me. But I walked up to him and I said, hi, I'm your arch nemesis. And he said, why? I said, well, you know, I'm always commenting on the things you get wrong. And he goes, well, it's okay. That's what the audience is for, you know, or something. It was pretty good. So, yeah. Any other questions? Well, be sure to come back for Hacking 101 and 201. I'm on both of those. And if you haven't been to Dragon Con before, especially Hacking 201, you're not going to want to miss 201. That's the place to be Sunday night. And we mean pretty much all night. It's very crazy stuff. Well, thank you all.